Not until later.
Oh, yeah, anytime you're ready, Eric and Vesta, do you want to give your short presentation?
Oh, yeah, sure.
Okay, we'll probably take it tomorrow. You might be able to hope to it, depending on how much time you got. Kind of work it up. Okay.
As long as we can keep everybody else quiet, it won't take an hour.
Okay, we'll see what we can do. And we have 2 hours on Friday.
Yeah.
Why don't we plan on a Friday, because then we have 2 hours on Friday.
Well, review. We're kind of zeroing in here. I think we're going to be at less than 35 here by the end of this week. It always takes a little longer than I thought, but it's well worth the time. So, lesson 20, these pronominal suffixes where we left off. And you recall that the major issue here is learning the suffixes, learning the paradigm for the suffixes, which is the same as basically what you had on your prepositions earlier, and then noting whether the suffix is a heavy or light suffix. The heavy suffixes result in double reduction of the stem if possible. In other words, the stem is going to look like the construct form with the heavy suffixes, the chem and chen, and your second person plural suffixes. And then everywhere else it's going to look like, just a single reduction, just like the plural had. Now, the feminine nouns, of course, have, in ah, have ah before the light suffixes and ah with the pathak before the heavy suffixes. So that's essentially the same kind of thing. Remember, in your construct reductions, a comets that's in the last closed syllable reduced to pathak. And so if you take the suffix off, that's kind of the way it is. The stem is like that of the construct before hem and chen, but it's just singly reduced elsewhere. So that's the major distinction there. Now, he lists a number of different categories of nouns and the kinds of changes that occur there. And notice that he's got the first person singular and then the second person plural each in each place, because that will be indicative of what happens. The suffix that's on the first person singular, the stem is going to be the same for all of the light suffixes, and the second person plural form, the stem will be the same for the heavy suffixes, of which there's only two. So you've got a complete description then, as far as using the rules and using this, you've got a complete description of what happens. So I don't think we'll take time to run through these. We may want to do it at your own leisure. The next thing we need to deal with is a plural noun. What do you do with a plural noun when you put the suffixes on it? Well, remember, first off, we had a little slightly different suffixes. We'd run into these slightly different suffixes earlier when we had the prepositions el and al. And we tried to put the suffixes on those. They were slightly different than the suffixes we put on li and so forth, on lama, etc. And those same suffixes show up again here on the plural forms. And he tells you to kind of think of this as the plural ending plus the pronominal suffix mixed together. So that's why you get kind of longer vowels and so forth. And that's perhaps one way to consider it. So instead of susi for my horse, it's susai for my horse is plural. It's still my singular, but horse is plural. In each of these cases, we've got a plural noun with pronominal suffixes that may be singular or plural. The suffix itself may be singular or plural, but the noun is plural with the set of suffixes. Okay, so it's susai, susaka, you get the sagol yod, susayik, susau, suseha, susenu, susehem, susehen, susehem, and susehen. Now in this set, we have four heavy suffixes. The ahem, ahen, and ahem, and ahen. Those suffixes are all considered heavy suffixes because all of them have two syllables and a closed syllable at the end. And so those are the ones where we're going to have to devote some special interest. Now, for the word davar, which, see, sus is nice because it's unchangeable long vowel, so it doesn't change. The stem never changes. But for davar, you have a little different situation. Of course, you're going to get the propretonic reduction that's normally expected here just because of adding a suffix just like you did with the plural. So divarai, divareka, divarayek, etc. But then when you get over to those heavy suffixes, divarenu and so forth above, then you get to divrechen, divrechen. There you get the double reduction again. you get that comments that's in the open syllable reduced also, and then you get rule of schwa applied, and so you get the same basic stem as you would have for the construct or something of that nature. You get the double reduction at least. And that's the same thing that happens in the plural construct form. The singular construct form would have a pafak in that second syllable and close it. But in the plural construct, you get that double reduction. So think of it in terms of this, that before the heavy suffixes, your stem is going to look like the plural construct stem. And before the light suffixes, it'll just look like that proprotonic reduction, that single reduction. So, he says, note the stress difference when the endings of second person and third person plural are added. That's the main problem. You've got two syllables in most all of these suffixes, or at least a number of them, but the difference with ahem and ahen is that the stress is on the last of those two syllables rather than the first of those two syllables, and that's what, in effect, makes it as though you've added two whole syllables to the word. So, here a noun with two changeable vowels will undergo the double reduction met in the plural construct form. Then nouns with plurals and oath add these same suffixes but directly to the plural ending without replacement. So with eem endings, you drop the eem off and add the suffixes. But with oath endings, you just leave the oath on and add the same suffixes. And of course, again, that's going to result in stress shifts and so forth when you get to the ahem and ahen type suffixes. And there you get double reductions again. But in this case, since you've already kept the oath on and added another suffix, you've pretty much gotten to total reduction by the time you even get to those. So the stem is going to look much different because it can't shorten anymore. For example, if you've got birchoth down here, it's birchothai, birchotheka. You see, you've already got three syllables, and the last one stressed, and everything's been reduced as much as it can. So generally, what you're going to see is that all the suffixes for these feminine plurals are going to have the same stem as the construct plural had. That's just because you're now adding... you're adding an effect to the original word, three whole syllables. And, I mean, you've already got things as short as you can when you do that. They're all going to look the same on those. Okay, then there's another list of nouns here in plurals. Yes, Tony?
Just a quick question. Why did they change the ahem to
where are you looking?
Susai.
That's because it's the plural form now. See, before...
Why did they change it to a pata? Wouldn't that still have been a hearing?
No, because this is a different set of endings. This set of endings is the plural ending suffixes that go on plural nouns. See, that pathak is telling you, in effect, that sus is plural. It's telling you that this is susim plus hirikyoth, not sus plus hirikyoth. See, susi is my horse, and susai is my horses. So that little difference makes a lot of difference in terms of whether it determines whether the noun itself is singular or plural. Okay? And you brought up a good point because that's the place where it's hardest to see. The other ones you can pretty well tell with that yod in there. You see that you've got all the rest of them have yod, but that first one doesn't have the yod, and so that would be, you've got to pay attention to that pathak there. Which means, obviously, that in the original text when there was no vowel points, the only difference between susi and susai would be context. And you really wouldn't be able to tell other than context because the form would look exactly the same. That's what generates a certain amount of debate sometimes with the form Adonai, and whether it's Adonai or Adoni. Adoni would be my Lord singular, Adonai would be the plural of majesty form. And the only difference is the pata versus the oath in the last syllable, and that wasn't a part of the original text, so you're kind of relying on the Masoretes a little bit as to which way it's to be taken.
So as far as interpretation goes, might there not be cases where they couldn't have any error?
Yeah, I think so. I think you should at least consider the possibility in a tight situation. Yeah, that it may be singular. That's right. Okay. That's about it for this chapter. Just noting one statement on page 90 here, right after this big list of nouns and examples. It says, note that oath plurals have the same stem as the construct plural before all the suffixes. And that's just what I noted. It's simply because you've added so many syllables on. Because you've kept the oath on, which has already already resulted in a reduction. Then you put another suffix on top of that, which forces another reduction, and now you've got double reduction. That's as far as you can go normally anyway. So that means that all of the stems of all of the forms will be like the construct. While im plurals have the construct plural stem only before hem, hen, hem, and hen, only before those heavy suffixes that you see it in the im plurals. And the reason for that is that the im plurals drop the im off before they added the suffix, so there's not, you're not adding two syllable systems onto it. So except in the ahem and ahen, where you're adding two syllables, the final one takes the stress. Okay, a noun with pronominal suffix is definite. So that's something to remember, too. If it's got the suffix on it, it's automatically definite. It doesn't need the article anymore. And but then the adjective that's modifying it, if it's attributed to it, it's going to have the definite article. So susi hechazak, my strong horse. It's not ha-susi. You don't need the ha. Since you've got susi, it's my horse. It's definite by virtue of the fact that it's being defined as my horse. And but then you need the article on the adjective to go with it, because in effect the suffix has made it definite. Okay, so that's something to remember. And that means also that when it's the direct object of a verb, you're not going to see the article on it, but you're going to need your F anyway, because the F denotes, is used before, to mark the a direct object that is definite. So ra'iti F susol is formed here. You need the F. When the noun refers to a part of the body, F is frequently omitted, so there's some idiomatic variations on this theme. If it's part of the body, they have a tendency to to ignore the F for... I don't have any theoretical reason for that. Maybe somebody can come up with one. Okay, lesson 21 then. It's a little bit of a breather here. The subject of stative verbs. Now, stative verbs are verbs that describe a state of being rather than an action. And in the category of stative verbs, he's put several different types of verbs, some that aren't even stative, just because their forms are like stative verbs. Basically, the stative verbs use a slightly different vowel pattern than the normal pathak type perfects that we've been looking at so far. So kaved, for example, you have a tseri in the second syllable instead of a pathak. And zakane, the same thing, a tseri in the second syllable instead of a pathak. And so that's the major distinction here. And he indicates that some verbs that may have had that reverted to the pathak type when they became, get a more definite action, like karav. But then there are other verbs that are transitive and take direct objects that still have this tseri pattern, like tsane, for example, he hated. So they're going to be put in this category too, as far as their forms are concerned. And then formally speaking, there are tseri verbs in the uncomplicated triliteral class, like kaved, where all three radicals are strong. Then in the three aleph class, where you have a quiescent aleph in the end, malay. And in the hollow verbs, we have mate, which is probably considered a two-vowel verb originally. And then there are colon-type verbs in the uncomplicated triliteral class. Colon-type means that the last that second syllable that normally had pathak got colon. There's in the hollow class, you've got bosh here. He was ashamed. The inflection of these verbs is given below in parallel columns to facilitate comparison. So you can take a look at these. There's nothing really problematical about these, except for once you get the idea that there's a different thematic vowel involved. With kaved, for example, you have a tseri in the first, in the third person masculine singular form, but then kavaza, kavavta, kavavt, kavavti, kavavu, kavavtem, kavavten, kavavnu. The rest of the paradigm is exactly like kafav. So it's only in that third person masculine singular form that anything's different. So that one's pretty nice. Yare there, that's a three aleph. That's a little bit different in that the tseri stays through most of the forms here and the aleph quiesces. So since tseri is long and like verbs like the three alephs that we met before kept a comets there, a longer form, so it happens here, but it's a tseri instead. So it's yare, yara'a, yaretha, yareth, etc., as you get the tseri following all the way through. Maith, to die, these are the harder, this is probably one of the harder ones just because it's so short. Maith, maitha, mata, and mat, so forth, mati. You've got to kind of watch the stem changes as you go through there and the fact that it's shorter. Yakol here, to be able, that's not too much of a problem. It's just a cholum there in all the forms, and everything else is pretty much the same as you would expect. Yakol, yakola, yakolta, yakolt, yakolti. The thing to watch mainly there is that in the yakoltem, yakolten, you've got a kamas chatuf there instead of cholum. Okay, and Bosch, same thing. You got a, you do get this home wow appearing there in the second person, third person feminine singular form, Boscha. But just kind of watch for the peculiarities and you'll recognize them. That's the main thing. We don't want to belabor this too long. Okay, then there's also, commonly, there's an adjective as well as a verb for these stated verbs. The verb form will be there, but then there'll be an adjective form that very often is exactly the same form as the verb. And you see the list of comparisons of those in the bottom of page 94. And that can generate a certain ambiguity in the third-person masculine singular form, where the masculine singular form, third-person masculine singular form may be identical to the adjective form. And the adjective form in the masculine singular. And so, example here is Zakein Ha'ish. It's ambiguous as to whether that means the man grew old or was old or has become old, or just an adjective, the man is old. So to decide that, you have to go by context, of course. But if you get any other gender or number than the third person masculine singular, then it'll be clear because the forms will be different for the adjective and the verb form. And he lists examples here. So Zakana Ha'isha and Zakena Ha'isha are different. The first is verbal, second is adjectival. So you can tell the difference in these other forms. Then he makes mention of the fact that these verbs, stated verbs, can be used in a similar way in comparatives, that you can use the preposition min just like you did with the adjective forms for these verbal forms. So Kaved Ha'ish Mimeni could be the man became more important than I. The man became greater than I, you see. Or the man became heavier than I, if you're talking about diets or something. Okay. Then stated verbs from geminate roots are inflected as vowels in the third person. The example is Tom here. It's a geminate root. And they give you the third person forms, which are a little different with the dogation to the forms. But then the rest of the inflection is like that of Savav. So if you just look back at your geminate paradigm, you'll see what happens to that. And then the nouns Av, Ach, and Peh have some peculiarities as far as the suffixes being added to them are concerned. These three nouns are similar in having hirik yod in the construct singular and before the suffixes. Note the variant forms of the suffixes. So the suffixes take on a little bit of variant forms and so forth as a result of this feature. And they are looking a little bit more like the plural suffixes and kind of a cross between the two. So you just have to look at the paradigms on these. For example, you see, the problem here is the construct form takes a hirik yod. So for the form for father, av, and the construct is avi. So avi can mean, with the chatef pathak there, is just father in construct. But it's also avi, my father, and you get the full comments on it. And avika, so forth, on down the line, that hirik yod kind of comes back into the stem, and you see it all the way through the paradigm, so it's making the suffixes look a little bit like those plural suffixes with the yod in them. So to look at it, you see, the thing that will happen to you is this. In seeing those forms, your tendency is going to want to look at them as plurals because of that yod in there, and it makes them kind of look like plural suffixes. So that's the thing to watch out for. Av, Ach, and Peh, those three nouns, father, brother, and mouth, are the ones to watch for in that respect. Then the plural forms are noteworthy. Of course, the plural forms are going to have to look a little bit different in order to make a difference there. And you can see achai, achecha, etc. They're kind of regular. But the vowel points are a little bit different. You see, that's going to be your major distinction between the singulars and the plural. It's that vowel that's under the faith in this case. That's going to make your primary difference between the two forms. Okay. So those are just little irritating complications. We come to the lesson 22, which deals with the imperfect. We're first introduced to the imperfect here. And we find the paradigm for that on page 99 with Kathav again. And with the imperfect, we find not only suffixes like we found with the perfect, but we find prefixes also introduced to the forms. And with the paradigm of Kathav, it becomes Yiktov, he will write. Tiktov, she will write. Tiktov, again, for you, masculine singular, will write. So the same form is used for both three third-person feminine singular and second-person masculine singular. Tiktovi, the feminine singular form, has got its own separate form. And then ektov. And yiktavu, tiktovna, for they, feminine plural, will write. Tiktavu, tiktovna, and niktov. So notice we've got more forms in this paradigm than we did for the paradigm of the perfect, and that's because in the third person, there is a contrast, there's a formal difference in the third person between the two genders. And but you do need to note that the feminine plural of the third and second persons are formally the same. So even though they've got the same form, you have to line them out in the paradigm because they're set up this way. They're third versus second person. So that Tiktovna form is the form he's referring to. Tiktovna, if you see it, can mean either they will write or you will write, depending on the context. And so you have the same form, but they do delineate and break it down a little bit more finely. Okay? Mainly your third person has got two forms. See, in the perfect, you just had kathavu, and that was for they wrote either masculine or feminine. But in the imperfect, they will write masculine is yiktavu, and they will write feminine is tiktovna. So you've got a distinction in gender there. Okay? So you just need to review the paradigm for that for kathav, make sure you've got that one down, and then you just, you know, consider all the irregularities as they come. Meaning of the imperfect, three categories here. First, just the simple future. He will write. That's a very common translation for it. Also, habitual or customary action, whether it's past, present, or future. If the action is of a habitual or customary nature, where it's not just a finite, but it's a more of an incomplete action or a drawn-out action or something, whether that's past, present, or future, it may be translated by the imperfect. And then there's a number of modal type of translations, and this modal is just kind of indicating the fact that the actual understanding of it is going to be determined by certain clause relationships and syntactic structures over and above the actual form. And that will transmit information as to how the thing should be translated. You'll get things like subjunctives and so forth out of this. English equivalents of may, might, would, could, can, should. You know, your subjunctives and optatives and that type of an idea is coming forth from these modal translations of the imperfect. So the imperfect is rather indefinite by itself. It relies upon context to fix its exact sense. And then the imperfect also is negated with the word lo, just like the perfect was. So lo yiktov would be he will not write, or does not write, or was not accustomed to write, any of those different senses. In poetry, you sometimes see all also used as a negative for the imperfect, in poetic passages and so forth. So you might see all yiktov there. And we'll see this lo and all a little bit later again when we get the imperatives. Questions, anybody, on the imperfect as it stands? So far in this chapter, all we need is learn the paradigm for the imperfect and then recognize the basic range of meanings that can be translated by it. For our purposes, we're normally going to either translate it in the future or in the habitual present or something like that. Those are the most common that we'll run into. The dual is a little bit more information given here. This ending, ayim, and in the construct, it goes to tseriol, just like the im ending. And it's generally used for things that are occurring in pairs in parts of the body and so forth, naturally occurring in pairs. And we have a list of those at the top of the next page there: hand, foot, loins, eye, ear, wing, horn, teeth, etc. Teeth is a little strange because we don't normally think of them occurring in pairs, but you got two rows of teeth. That's the way they're looking at it, uppers and lowers. Okay. And then certain time measurements, same thing, 2 days, 2 years, 2 weeks, twice, two evenings. Noon is this way, and there's question as to the origin of that concept, but whether it's dividing the day into two parts or just what the idea was. Two cubits also apparently is used enough to justify a dual form. Now, what do you do with an adjective that modifies a dual form? You just use the plural form. So these dual endings do not carry over to the adjectives. You just use the plural forms for that. And when you put suffixes on a dual form and so forth, it's just like it is if it were plural. Okay. Questions, anyone, on this chapter? All right. Imperfect in Pathak, lesson 23. Now we get to one of our first categories of irregularities with the imperfect, or differences. Your normal perfect is going to have the stem vowel, the second vowel, in holon. Yiktov, for example, in the imperfect. The stative verbs of the types kavev and katon, as well as all verbs with a guttural consonant in the second or third position. See, we've got some visitors in here. Yeah, where is he at now? Okay. He doesn't give me too much trouble here. Those things have been ferocious here lately. I don't know. I may need to drive him out of the place. I don't know what that is. You know, it can't be the hair tonic I use because I don't have any on it. Okay. Well, you keep me posted in case I'm in danger here. There's certain classes that are going to take prothok, and it's either these stative verbs or if there's a guttural in the second or third position, which makes it a little simpler. If you just remember that kind of thing, you know what to expect for prothok type imperfects. So they get prothok instead of holam. So the paradigm is, you know, you don't even have to bother with it. If you just know that fact, you can just substitute prothok. So instead of, for example, for kaved, instead of what you would expect, yik bod, it's yik bod. And, of course, that follows through all the way through the paradigm. So nothing too much to say there. So he gives an example first of a stative verb, yikbav, and then yishma, which is a verb that has a third guttural in the third position, and then yivkar, which is a guttural in the second position. They all do the same thing. Then there's also a certain number of verbs that... These are the unpredictable ones. They'll also take prothok type imperfects, although to look at the verb you would never guess it. They look like a perfectly strong verb, and normally, like shakav, for example, there's no intrinsic reason why it couldn't be yishkov, just after the manner of other verbs, but it turns out to be a prothok imperfect. So those verbs you just have to learn as they come. And the three that we've had so far, yishkov, to lie down, from shakav, Lamav, to learn, and Rakav, to ride. I think they're probably even introduced in this lesson.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yeah, did we write those in later? Yeah. Did you have them down, written in? Okay. Yeah, we probably did that just to complete the list. Those are ones we probably ran into later on. Either that or ones we were given. It was Shalach, and what else?
Batak.
Okay, both of those end in Chet, so they would be under the category of a three guttural, so those would be automatically reckoned in that category. Okay, then section 95, verbs 3 aleph in the imperfect. Same kind of thing happens here as in the perfect, the quiescence of the aleph and the lengthening of the stem vowel as a result of it. Now, first of all, you can predict that the stem vowel would be prothok on these just because of the fact that it's a guttural in the third position. And now, since it's an aleph, though, you have an additional factor of the prothok being lengthened to comets because of the compensatory lengthening. And so if you just keep those in mind, then the paradigm is going to be pretty straightforward. But the only thing you probably could stumble over is in these third-person feminine plural and second-person feminine plural forms, where you get tikrena instead of tikrana or something. It's tikrena. You get a segol in that form. So you just watch for that. But everywhere else, it's a comets as that thematic vowel. So it's yikra, yikra, etc. Yikra, tikra, excuse me. And tikra, tikra, e, etc. Ekra. So you get the quiescent aleph and you lose a syllable. Okay, then now the nouns ben and shame, bane and shame. These two nouns are similar in the singular before suffixes in that the stem vowel is reduced to shua. So this may have something to do with the fact that both of these nouns can occur as a proclitic, you might say, to another noun with makef. They both these two were singled out before as ones that would shorten, and you'd get ben in front instead of bane in front of another noun. That may have something to do with it, but they also, as we see here, reduce the stem vowel to shawa before the suffixes. So it's beni, benecha, etc. You get rule of shawa involved in some of these, but you get that shawa reduction and shami, etc., also for shame. Remember that the plural of bane is banim and that of shame is shemoth. There is no irregularity in these plural forms before pronominal suffixes. So they're going to follow the normal rules for plurals. Okay, questions on these, on this chapter? Okay, then lesson 24 gave us one of our more important syntactic. lessons, and that was having to do with these narrative sequences. And there's probably nothing more Hebrew than narrative sequences. That's really as Hebrew as you get. And the basic situation here is the fact that in Hebrew, when you're dealing with a narrative sequence in which you're describing actions and events and so forth in a sequence or in order, telling a story, most often in historical narrative, where in which a good percentage of the Old Testament is, they employ a mechanism to transmit the information that you have consecutive action taking place. And that mechanism is to use, first of all, if you're dealing with a past tense, to use a form of the perfect to start your series and then continue the series with imperfect. Or, in reverse, you can start off with an imperfect and then continue with perfects if you're trying to talk about a sequence in the future or in a habitual present or in some modal sense. And this fact has constituted a lot of controversy and question in people's minds and exactly how to interpret it and so forth. I guess the bottom line is Hebrew does it, whether we like it or not. And what we need to do is begin to try to glean for our own understanding the kind of information that's being transmitted by these things. That's not too difficult to do. When you get into the question of why they did it or how they ever originated this idea, that is open to a lot of speculation. The way I like to think of it for my purposes, and it may or may not be accurate as to how things happen, since nobody knows that, but I like to think of it as a certain kind of a time projection in which, for example, if you're starting out with perfect and then continuing in imperfects in the past to talk about past events, the idea seems to be you start out with a perfect, so you set your time value, but then you bring the reader with you back into that time and use imperfect forms as if things are going on right in front of us. And Jung, I think, kind of favors an idea like that. That's why he goes ahead and translates them literally. He ignores this conversion of the tense, and he goes ahead and translates them in, you know, the imperfect as presents or futures or something. I can't remember what he uses. And that, you know, person reads that, he gets kind of confused. But if you think in terms of this projection idea, it may help. The same with the future series, where you start off with an imperfect and then you use continuing perfects. That one may be a little harder to see, but it may be as though they're talking about something in the future, and they're bringing you up into the future and as if you have already experienced it, and then using past verb forms for it. So that would be more, you know, what you'd expect for prophecy and that type of thing, where God is looking at it as if it's already happened. Yes?
When the improvised poem was referred to, that to past tense,
mm-hmm.
It is really in perfect tense.
Many of those are. There's no imperfect starting a series. They're just playing in the perfect. So, again, we know that happens. And then, again, this kind of a series starting with an imperfect continuing perfect is relatively rare. You don't see it very often, but the speculation is that that's maybe what it's connoting. We don't, you know, all we can do is make a guess at it. But like you say, there are very many times in which a prophecy is just given in the past tense without any series involved, sequence involved, and it's just got a past tense value. And the only way you can tell it's prophecy is from context and so forth, and parallel passages and things like that. And from that we get, again, another concept that God, at least, is looking at things as if they've already happened. Okay? Good. Now, the first series we want to look at is the Perfect Plus Imperfect series here at page, letter A on page 107. And the Perfect Plus Imperfect sequence is used mainly for past tense narration and is extremely common throughout the Old Testament. The mark of the sequence is a special form of the conjunction wa plus doubling, joining the verbs in the sequence. So, normally, before we've been used to the conjunction, just putting wa in front, wa with shawa, and in some instances having to have some modifications of that form depending on gutturals and so forth. But here we see a wa plus doubling. And we see, a wow with pathak plus a doubling is the special form that's used for this kind of a narrative sequence. And so it's only going to be attached to imperfect verb forms. And such sequences may continue for dozens of clauses, each of which, if it is a part of the main narrative, begins with the verb in the imperfect with the conjunction prefixed. So that's going to be a key to continuing the narration. Each clause that's a part of the narrative is going to continue, begin with the verb with this while consecutive form attached to it. So an example, kam ha'ish wa yidrosh, the man arose and sought. Okay, we're starting out with a perfect form of the verb, come, and then we have our subject, and then we have a continuation, another verb form, this time introduced with a conjunction wa plus the doubling of the first the prefix there, the yod there. And that is telling us the man arose and sought. In other words, he arose and then he sought. The arising occurred first and then he sought, and then, of course, it could continue on with other verb forms. Amaz wa yikra, he stood and called. There you don't have the actual subject stated, but amaz, of course, supplies that in the third person masculine singular. He stood and then called. The subject need not be the same in each clause. So we don't need to limit this to only having one subject doing a bunch of things in sequence, but the things that are done in sequence may be done by many different subjects. The man may have arisen, and the woman sought, and the child went, and so forth. In other words, you can have different subjects and so forth, but each time the verb will be first in the clause. So, example here, he sat down near the temple, and the people called to him, and he hearkened in their voice, and so forth. Same kind of idea there. We'll take time to read through all the Hebrew here right now. Now, the form of the conjunction is illustrated by these following examples. You've got Wayik Tov, there you've got Pathak plus a doubling. Wa Tik Tov, Pathak plus a doubling. Wa Ek Tov, that one's a little unusual because you can't double the Aleph, so you get compensatory lengthening and you get the comments there. And Wayik Tavu, Wa Tik Tavu, Wa Nik Tov, they're all straightforward then. So the only place you run into a problem is with the Aleph. And see, these are always going to be attached to imperfect verb forms. And so there's only a certain class of letters that are going to even, you know, get this wa consecutive form attached to them. And the only one of those at the guttural is the aleph. So that's the only one you have to worry about. All right. Now, he says all past tense narrative in which each verb is temporally or logically consequent upon the preceding verb employs this sequence. The imperfect so used take on the tense value of the perfect and are said to be converted. That's where the idea of while conversive comes from. The idea of conversion, meaning that the meaning of the verb form is converted to the meaning of the verb form that started out the sequence. So an imperfect form is converted to perfect meaning, is the idea. And while consecutive is another description that is given in the various grammar books for it. That's just connoting the idea that it's consecutive, that each event is consequent upon the next, upon the one before it. Okay, now the perfect value of the form wa plus imperfect became so commonplace that it may be employed even without a perfect to begin the sequence. So because it's used so frequently, there are some instances where it's alleged that it begins out that way. And the question may come there, is it really beginning that way, or is it just consequent on a previous statement, a previous verse or something like that. Although I suspect that what's happened here is that there was probably something that broke up the sequence. And then they went ahead and resumed it without starting with a perfect form. So they concluded that what they're doing is just picking it up. So perhaps in an instance like that, something grammatically broke up the sequence, but conceptually the thought was still running along and they didn't take the time to start off with another form and just continue. It became such a commonplace grammatical thing that the meaning was being expressed anyway. This doesn't mean that the biblical writers broke the grammatical rules. It just means that the rules were probably looser and not so rigid because of the commonplace expression of this kind of thing. Okay, then you see this next series, the imperfect plus the perfect sequence, is used with all the meanings of the imperfect, whether future or habitual durative. The conjunction before the perfect is normal and pointed according to the regular rules given in section 46. So you don't have a special form of the wa consecutive of the wa itself when you're dealing with when you're sticking them onto perfect. You just use the normal form that you've seen before. And that makes it a little bit more difficult to identify a series like this. With the wa consecutive series that we just talked about, it's easy to identify that you got the series just by the form of the wa. You notice that, you know, wa with the pathak there and the doubling, that sticks out, and you know you're dealing with a narrative sequence. In this situation, you have to look a little bit more closely because the form of the wa is the normal form that would be used. So you have to look and see if there was an imperfect that started the sequence in order to determine whether there's a consecution being implied or not. So it may just be saying this happened and this happened and this happened and this happened. In other words, telling you all the things that happened, but not necessarily in that order. But if it starts out with an imperfect to introduce the series, then it does happen in this order. So The conjunction is the normal form. A few examples here. You don't see this one nearly as commonly. So, yimsa otho winathan lo ethakese. He will find him and give him the money. So you start off with an imperfect, he will find him. And then winathan, you go back to a perfect form with the normal form of the conjunction, and that would indicate that he will find him and then give him the money. It'll happen in that sequence. Okay, if the first imperfect is used in the habitual sense, this is carried through the sequence. So if the context has established that your first imperfect is the habitual type of sense, where an example here, he used to call the prophet and say, rather than he will call the prophet and say, that same idea is carried through the sequence, and each one of them, he used to call the prophet and used to say. That's kind of the idea that's being transmitted there. Okay, then this next point is important. Note that when a negative clause is inserted into the sequence, the verb is no longer first. Remember, to negate a verb, you put lo out in front of the verb. Now, if you put lo in front of the verb, that means the verb doesn't stand first anymore, and that is going to break up the sequence. And and there are other things that can do it too, but this is one of the most common ways. So the verb of the negative clause is then in its normal non-converted form. Okay, so if you put a negative out in front of it, you've got to, in effect, start the series over again, or you can get back into it, but you've got to use the real live form that would be required there, not a converted form. So, halaku, wayikru'u, elau, willo shama. They went and called to him, but he did not hear. Okay, you can't. Now, suppose you wanted to say, they went and called to him, and he heard. You could go ahead, if you did that, and use an imperfect form, and say just, and wayishma, and use a converted form and an imperfect form, and that'd be fine. But it says, because he did not hear, you have to negate it, that puts lo in there, and now you've got to use a real live perfect form, because you're trying to tell something about it, something that happened in the past. And of course now, if it says, and he did not hear, and then he prophesied, or something like that, you could go back and in the very next verb form, go back to an imperfect form, because now your shama has started is a perfect form that could start a new series, and then the next one could go back to the imperfect. You see, and that commonly happens. Yes, Tony.
When they translated it flat here,
right.
Would it have been better to say "can"?
Well,
it seems to be a contrast.
Yeah, that's only gleaned from context. There isn't even a word for "but" in Hebrew. It's always "wa." And you have to kind of decide. See, English have a little more refinement, whether you're dealing with a contrast or whether just, you know, something more of the same kind. Hebrew doesn't have that, so that's going to have to be determined by context. So they're just saying they went and called to him, but he did not hear. The contrast is that he didn't respond to their call, as you normally would expect. So that's why they put a "but" in there. Although "and" would be just as accurate. It'd be a little bit less committal, too. Sometimes you may want to, if you're not sure if there's a contrast implied, you best just use "and," because "and" will work either way. If it's obvious that there's a contrast implied, then "but" is fine. Okay, so it says here, after such an interruption, the original sequence may be resumed by reverting to the converted forms. This and other complications will be dealt with below. Okay, then there's a little note here that probably isn't worth spending a lot of time with. He just talked about the fact that the second person masculine singular form and the first person singular form, when they're converted, in the converted perfect, there's no separate form for a while, but there will often be an accent shift to the final syllable. So wikathavti instead of wikathavti is just a slight accent shift to the final syllable, and wikathavta rather than wikathavta. So the pointing is unaffected by the stress, does not take place in all instances, so it's not really worth paying a whole lot of attention to. It's not going to change any meaning. Okay, then segalets again, some more information on those. These segalet nouns, now when you're putting suffixes on them, revert to a particular stem in the singular, and it's the same kind of thing we ran into with a construct and with plurals. So here we find he's got four different categories. It kind of depends on what vowels it has, and you can't even be sure always, once you know that, which way it's going to act. So So there are four main group types of cyclic nouns represented by melech. The construct is just melech, and the suffix is malki. You get the pathak there. So that's kind of the thematic ball for it. And melachim, the plural, has a certain pattern that we already learned about. But then when you go to the construct, then you have to know what it gets that pathak again. So this is one that gets pathak in all those ambiguous places. Kever, construct is kever, of course, that doesn't change. And then with the suffix, it's kivri, and you get hirik in all those ambiguous places. Sefer, also you get hirik. And kodesh, you get kamos katuf, kodeshi, and so forth. So that's your thematic vowel on that one. So he just summarizes, nouns with seri have characteristic hirik, those with cholim have characteristic kamos katuf. But those with segol may have either pathak or hirik. See, melech has segol and it's got pathak, whereas kever has got segol and it has hirik. So you really don't know which one they're going to do. They've got to be learned with each noun. So with the sefer type and the kodesh type, those last two types, you can predict what they're going to do. But with a melech type, with two segols, you don't know for sure what they're going to do. Most of them take pathak, and he lists almost all the ones we've had so far take pathak, except kever and sedek, they take the hirik. So if you're forced to guess, you probably guess pathak, that's the more common, but you can't tell for sure. Okay, remarks on prepositions. This is dealing with introducing this concept that we'll see explored in many other examples, but what they will often do in making prepositions is to do it with nouns that have been in construct or something and then put another one of their other prepositions on it. They try to make a lot of different prepositions out of existing words. So here's an example with panim, which is a noun meaning face that's found only in the plural. It's another one of those, not a real plural of majesty probably here, but it's a plural of extent or a plural just indicating the many different types of, you know, the fact that your face can express itself in many different ways. It's got the construct form lifne. Well, this form, this word lifne, is taking the form face, putting it in construct, and putting the preposition lamed on it. And they get from that a preposition in the presence of or before. See, literally it means to the faces of, or to the faces. You see, to the faces of, because the of comes from the construct. It's in construct, and you're kind of begging for something else to follow, and it'll be attached to some other noun. And the preposition lama gives you the to. So it's to the faces of, you see, the idea of in the presence or before is pretty appropriate. And mipne, from the presence of or from before, see, from the preposition min, same idea, now in the opposite direction. Alpine, upon the surface of or up against, that makes sense too, on the face of, literally. So it's kind of a clever way that this has been done. Then there's putting the pronominal suffixes on the same thing. And so if you want to say before me, it's lipanai, lipanai, which is just putting that, remember that pathak, the old suffix, is the thing you stick onto a plural noun, which panim was, for first person singular suffix. So it would be my faces, literally, or my, in other words, to my faces, literally, or face, even though it's a plural form. So it would be before me, and lifaneka, and so forth, same kind of thing. Then another section here, many prepositions like the preceding are compounded from a simple preposition plus a noun. Suffixes are attached according to the rule applying to the noun type in question. So you can take a preposition you already had, put another noun with it, and then put suffixes on the noun like you normally would have. So al davar, for example, because of, literally upon the matter or upon the thing, concerning the thing, you see, because of this. You can see how they're making these connections. And then, of course, you could put a suffix on, because of me, for example, would be al divari, upon my thing, see, upon my matter. Okay, and then betholk, just the preposition beth plus the noun folk, and so it would be in midst, and betholk meaning midst, and so betholk would be in the midst. And bekerev, in the midst of also, it's got the same idea. Then even simple prepositions may be compounded with one another for greater clarity. Most of these are self-explanatory. So you'll run into these. May all is just the preposition min plus the preposition all, meaning upon. So it would mean from upon, from on. It makes all the sense in the world. May eighth, from with or from at. Mitachat, from under. Tachat meaning under, and mitachat would be from under. So that's pretty logical. Any questions there on this chapter? Narrative sequences, though, is the major point in this chapter, and one that we dare not forget. It's not too easy, not too difficult to remember, I don't think. Okay, lesson 25, imperative. What would be the imperative? What does imperative signify? When would you use an imperative? Command, right. When you're wanting to impose your will on someone else, when you're making a command or instruction of this nature. So imperative is actually a mood in Greek, in the Greek construction, and in Hebrew there's just a separate form for the imperative, and it's a form that's pretty much derived from the imperfect. If you know what the imperfect is, you can usually figure out what the imperative is, unless it's got some exceptions. So the basic stem of the imperative is always closely related to that of the imperfect and can be deduced from it. So, for example, if the imperfect is yiktov, the imperative is ketov. So basically, you cut the yuh off the front and take what you have left. And the begat kefad is usually going to shorten then, because now the first syllable was no longer closing a syllable. So that's the reason it becomes ketov, because now the shawah is vocal and now you have a vowel sound in front of the begat kefad. If it's a pafak type imperfect, though, it'll retain the pafak in the imperative. So yishkav will become shakav. And if you look at the last example there with the quiescent aleph, that will also carry through to the imperfect. So from the imperfect to the imperative. So yikra becomes kara. Okay, so that's pretty straightforward. Now, that's only good for the second person masculine singular form. Now, remember, your imperative is second person. You're addressing somebody when you're making a command. You're talking to a you someplace. And that you may be masculine or feminine. It may be singular or plural. So you can make a command to one individual or to many individuals. And therefore, the form of the imperative is going to give you the information as to the gender and the number that you're talking to. So that means you've got at least four forms to concern yourself with now. And the forms are made in a pretty regular fashion. Once having found the masculine form, singular, then to form the plural, you just add shirek to it. To form the feminine, you add hirikyo. And to form the plural feminine, you add na to it. And that may result in some vowel changes and so forth, too. So kethov, for example, looking at the paradigm here, looking across, kethov is the second person masculine form. Kith-V would be your feminine form, adding hirik-yol to it, and of course that's adding a syllable to it, and that's going to reduce the cholam to shua, or at least that's effectively what happens. It may be best just to think of this as a paradigm, I'm not sure. But that becomes kith-V, and then kith-Vu, and kithovna for your feminine plural form. Shaka becomes shik-vi, shik-vu, shikavna. And Shema, Shemi, Shem'u, Shemana, etc. Okay, then there's a little point up here that stumbles you once in a while, because they don't occur often enough to really see them, a lot of them, but when they do occur, you've got to watch out for them. And that is that the suffix kamate occurs frequently on the masculine singular imperative with no striking modification in meaning. The stem usually appears with kamat chatuf before this suffix. So, instead of seeing kathov, sometimes you may see kothba for second person masculine singular form, and you just have to be on the lookout for it, because it'll occur apparently often enough to be a problem. Verbs with tafak imperfects have hirik instead of the kamas katuf there, so you get shikva and shilcha, so you'll see that variation as well. Then the negative of the imperative, and this is something else to remember. The negative in the imperative is not lo plus an imperative. It's lo plus the imperfect, or all plus the imperfect, depending on what aspect you're looking at. So we're going back to imperfect forms to give the negative of the imperative. And so all plus the imperfect is for a specific immediate command. Lo plus the imperfect is for durative or non-specific commands, more of a long-range nature. Okay, that's a good place to stop here, and we're making more progress here. A lot of these next chapters are going to be a lot of minute details. We'll go through them fairly fast, and before you know it, we'll be up to lesson 35, and we'll be back to doing exercises. Get kind of a break here for a while, just kind of look at things.
No homework to worry about.
Yeah, I think it's really a necessity, because if we'd have plugged into chapter 35 the first day, we'd be